and then my basic training in Fort William at the 102nd Training Center in Fort William. And when we finished that, I went to Fort Osmond Barracks. That's where we were when the Grenadiers were looking for reinforcements to go to overseas. We knew it was going to be the Far East, but we didn't know for sure where it was. The rumors were that we were going to Singapore, and after we got on the boat, we found out we were going to Hong Kong.
Excuse me, while you were in Winnipeg, did you receive much training while you were at Menlo Barracks or Fort Osmond Barracks?
I was in Fort Osmond Barracks, and well, we had about a month's training there in Fort Osmond.
This would be in small arms, or...?
Well, company drill and small arms, yeah. Mm-hmm. And when the Grenadiers asked for reinforcement, I was one of the first ones to transfer to the Grenadiers. And then there was quite a few there from the Leesburg Regiment that also wanted. I imagine there would be about a dozen former Leesburg Regiment transferred to the Grenadiers. From there, from Fort Osmond, it took us to the Robinson Building. Went there very long, about a week. And they gave us whatever kit we needed. And if I remember right, it was the 25th of October, 41, that we got on the boat, on the train to go to Vancouver.
You were never in Jamaica then? You were
I was in 1941. Mm-hmm. From where we went to Vancouver, we got on the boat, the Awatia, and nobody liked the idea of the boat too much. For the simple reason that with that boat there was too many places out of bounds. All the good part of the ship was all out of bounds, reserved for the officers and NCOs, and the men were in the back end of the boat, and we in down the hole. There was a tremendous amount of resentment about that. There was also, that night, after supper, there was nearly a riot on board ship. Some people, you know, went off the ship, jumped off the ship. And rather than wait till the next day and so on, the ship left the harbor early.
Did these men get back on again?
No. Some of them went, some come back. Some stayed on the absent without leave. Some did come back on board ship, and then they put a couple of men with arms on the gangplank there and prevent anybody from getting off. Mm-hmm. So,
what was your trip over to Hong Kong like? Was it rough or smooth, or any stopovers that you had?
Well, the trip was, Pacific is a fairly smooth ocean to sail on, but it was, like I say, we were in the deep end of the ship, and it was hot. The quarters were terrible, as far as I'm concerned. In wartime, you shouldn't squawk too much, but the way the ship was built, where we, there was great big open places where you ate, where you're supposed to be your living quarters, and you slept in hammocks above your tables. And we certainly didn't like this idea because people were sick for the hammock and threw up all over the place and threw up at the table where you're going to eat next breakfast, your breakfast or your meal. So we figured it was more as a cattle boat.
Yeah.
And there you are, guys with dirty feet get on the table to get into the hammocks, and it was so hot down below, you see. And there was the lounges and so on, but we were not allowed to go in the lounges. They were out of bounds. And this is what, there was so much resentment about that. We did go to the lounges a few nights, but when there was concerts and so on. But at the front end of the ship, all the good, the decent penalties. The privates were nothing. And the lower rank were not allowed there.
Did you know at this time where you were going exactly? Or
well, as we were on board ship, I don't know if it was before we went to Honolulu or after we went to Hawaii. Honolulu was in Hawaii. We were told we were going to Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
Then on board ship.
So you stopped at Hawaii on the way over
there? We stopped at Hawaii. And we'll come back again to board ship there. That was a button boat. We ate practically nothing but mutton. Mutton stew. And I remember one meal we had was tripe. That didn't go very well with Canadians, I'll tell you that much. And on board ship, like I say, everybody was complaining about the food and so on. Especially the younger ones, everybody was going on, bah! That's all you heard all day long on board ship. I know that the crew and the orderly officer and so on came down and tried to quieten us down, but it didn't matter very much. After we went to Hawaii, we got some bologna and some wieners and so on, and we had a couple of decent meals, if you call that a decent meal.
Yeah,
but tripe and mutton, my gosh. The setup was so poor. Coming back, we came back on board an American ship, and it's a completely different, you know.
Mm.
Although the American ship, they were piled like sardines, but at least you went down to a mess hall and ate.
Yeah, okay.
And there was not so much rank difference.
Yeah. So what were your first impressions when you landed in Hong Kong? What did you think of the city when you saw?
Well, I mean, we're in the tropics, it was hot and so on, and we didn't, I mean, we liked it and so on. It was tropical, we're not used to that and so on. Another thing too, that what makes me laugh, you think of that, and I always remember that, before we landed in Hong Kong, we were told to take our flashes off, you know, Canadian flashes, and if we're interviewed or anybody asks us anything, we were not to say anything, we're not to say we're Canadians, we're not to tell them the name of our regiment or anything whatsoever, keep quiet. So we marched on into camp, Sham Shui Po camp, and there's the paper, newspaper, Hong Kong newspapers, Canadian land in Hong Kong, and there was all the whole thing about the Canadian forces and who was commanding the Canadian forces and so on, you see. So, I mean, there you are again.
It was much of a secret.
No, but the guys would say, well, the officer says, well, they wanted you to say anything, they wanted to keep everything to themselves, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, as far as the morale is concerned, the morale, the man and the officers never got along fine.
What company were you
in? I was with headquarters company. Number four platoon headquarters company. I was with the motorcycle section.
Mm-hmm.
And there was Lieutenant French was actually the section commander. And Lieutenant Briquette was the platoon commander.
And what kind of training did you have when you were in Hong Kong? Did you train very much while you were stationed there?
Well, no, we had nothing to train with. Not very much. We were hanging around. You were motorcycle section. We were waiting for our motorcycles to do part of our training, which we never got the motorcycles. The same thing with the Bren Gun carriers. Well, the Bren Gun carriers, we borrowed one from the British, and we did look at it, tie it up, and so on, you know, but there's nothing we could do. But one time we went to up in our positions on the hills.
This was on the island, wasn't it?
On the island, yes, we go down there, and we spent a few days there. And when the war broke out, which was on the Sunday, that's when Pearl Harbor was bombed. We were in the hills already, our positions. And I remember it was after breakfast. We heard these planes coming, and we heard bombs falling, and we knew we were at war. I knew at least I was at war then, when the Japanese started bombing.
Well, up to this time, did you really expect there was going to be a war, or did you just think it was more garrison duty? Hong Kong. Did you have any
idea? No, we had been told on board ship that we were definitely going to war. There wasn't going to be no holiday, and war was definitely, as far as I'm concerned, war was coming.
So you weren't caught completely by surprise, you more or less expected it?
Not myself, anyway. Because we're expecting, don't forget, I was pretty young, I was 17 years old then.
And
if it was today, I might have different opinions, you see.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as I'm concerned, the war was coming. We were there.
So you expected it. Can you describe where you were during the battle and the battle a little itself?
Well, our position was at Wan Chai Gap, where the crossroad Wan Chai Gap.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not too sure where the place is, but as far as I'm concerned, when we were on there until the 19th, from December the 8th to the 19th, when the war broke out, and on the 19th, when the Japanese invaded the island, we left in the middle of the night, and during the night, and we went, which it was said we're going to Shushan Hills. And going down there, the Japanese were shelling. And we went to shelling there. They were shelling the heavily, and we went there. At daylight, this is when we met the Japanese.
Was this the first time you came into actual fighting, or were you fighting from the 8th until the 19th?
No, I started on my platoon was started on December the 19th. And the action wasn't very long because there was only a little bunch of us, and I was wounded in the leg and in the arm, and we were ordered to withdraw from there.
So,
of course, being wounded, I was helped by a couple of fellows. One of them was killed carrying me, and the other one was shot in the leg and went rolling down the hill. He went one way and I went the other way, and we never met one another until after we were in the prison camp. But this fellow was shot and wounded in the leg, told me that this other guy, and he had seen him and he had been killed. From there I wandered around the hills from the morning of the 19th until around the 23rd. There I met George Wheatcroft. He had been wounded through the chest too. And you see, no food, being wounded, no water. I was still delirious. So I finally found water on the 23rd. And I remember that drinking water in the ravine. But then the only thing you have in your mind is water, water, water. And I remember I was delirious and I was shouting. And this is how Wheatcroft found me, because he could hear me calling for help and he couldn't hear me talk, you see, because I was delirious. And he came crawling to me, but then I found water. And I heard some noise and I peeked around the rock, big boulder, and I seen this fella look up and we both ducked. I waved to him and he came down. He could walk fairly good because his legs were good, but he was shot right through the chest. He had one of the sucking chest wound. And then he helped me to walk, you see. Then we made our way, we were going, making our way to the Queen Mary Hospital. We were captured with the Japs then. Before we were captured with the Japs, we came down to this place. There was a house there. We could see Queen Mary Hospital. We came down to this place and there was some Chinese down there. And they were very scared. And they were motioning to us, Japanese, and they were all around, signaling that was all around there. I guess the Japs must have seen us coming there, because when we came out of there, they met us on the road. And the Chinese, I was thirsty. We were thirsty, you see, and I was asking for water. And I remember there was a tap outside of the house to water a lawn or something like that. And one of the Chinese gave me a bowl and I drank some water then. And they gave me a bit of rice and an egg, boiled egg. I guess they give wheat crop the same thing.
So,
but we couldn't eat the rice. It was just boiled rice, and it wasn't food so much as we wanted. Water,
yeah.
Dying of thirst. You see, being wounded, we lost a lot of blood. You see, and so anyway, we left there. We knew that the Chinese didn't want us. We were not wanted. It wasn't that they didn't want us, but they were afraid for themselves. They were scared. They were very scared. And there we left. We went down the road, and like I say, heading for Queen Mary Hospital. We could see it from where we were, because it's all hills in Hong Kong. It's either you go, you go up or down. You see. And there, but we were going down the road, and the first thing we knew, there was Japs all around us.
Were you armed at this time? Did you have rifles?
No. No.
So they didn't shoot or anything?
No. The only thing I had my... Well, of course, there was no fighting spirit then. I'd been wounded since the 19th, and nothing to eat. And it's water that's the main thing, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And then what the Japanese did there, they tied our hands together behind our back, both of us, with a string. They made us walk, and then there was a place, there was a curve in the road, and there was a trench dug down there, machine gun pit there, and they motioned to us to get down the trench. So when we got down the trench, I told Wee Croft, I says, well, if you got up there, see it, because I thought for sure they was going to shoot us. And then we got in the hole, that hole there, the trench. They were pointing their guns at us and screaming and hollering and so on.
They couldn't speak English?
They were shouting in Japanese and tried, and so on. And I found out later on what they wanted. They wanted us to beg for mercy, and we didn't.
Uh-huh.
And that's why we weren't killed. Because if we had begged for mercy, they would have tortured us to death then.
Mm-hmm.
This I know, because I've seen it done any time with the Chinese and so on. They beg for mercy, they just egg them on to torture you. It has happened to their prisoners of war.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have happened to us, but it just happened. What's the use? We're going to die anyway, so we might as well die peacefully. And then from that trench, they made us crawl out of there. And partly pulled us out of that trench, and so on, with my wounded leg, I couldn't handle myself too well. And they made us, motioned to us to walk down the road with our hands up in the air. So we marched, we started walking down the road slowly, we Croft and I. Nothing we could do, and they had the guns, we didn't. So we went down quite a ways. Then I know what they wanted. They wanted us to try to escape so they could shoot us and torture us. But we just walked down, that's all we did. They screamed, so we turned around, and they motioned us to come back. So we hobbled back to where they were, and then they tied us to a tree there. And we were there, that was early in the morning, almost seemed because maybe around 9 o'clock. By that time, the sun was shining, it was pretty hot. And then I was asking for water again. See, and so did Wee Croft, but I was always the one I was looking for water because I was always so thirsty. And one time they did give us a few mouthful of water, because there was a Japanese that could speak a few words in English, and I asked him to some water, and he understood what I wanted and gave an order to somebody, but they did give me a few mouthful of water. That afternoon there was a bunch of internees, these were civilians, coming down the road. And as the entrainees come down, they untied us from that tree. And they did beat us quite a few times when we were on that tree. You know, so one of the guys would come down and take a couple of belts at us and try his jujitsu on us. You know, so so anyway, when we got on this is where I met Gwen Dew. She was a newspaper correspondent for, if I remember right, the Detroit News. I have a book written by her here. I could verify which newspaper she was. And as I was hobbling around, Wheatcroft and one went ahead of the column, and I was could hardly keep up, you see.
But you could walk by yourself. You didn't need any.
While hobbled around, so as best I could, you see. And anyway, this is part of Gwen Dew Buchanan's book. She wrote Prisoner of the Japs, and I got an autograph copy of that book. She says in her book that I was walking, and the little Jap, to the court over to her. She was holding me. I was still tied by the wrists, you see, behind my back. And anyway, she helped me to walk. And we walked quite a bit. We stopped at another place there. And again I was asking for water. And there were some of the British, the internees, now these were British, maybe a few Americans. I remember that they came and gave me a couple of pieces of chocolate. And I managed to get some water again. Then from there, we marched down, but I couldn't keep up with them, you see. So anyway, we spent the night under a stair, which it says it was a soap factory. I don't know, but this is hearsay, soap factory. And that was Christmas Eve. That was the 24th.
Did you know that they were still fighting, or did you know?
Yes, they were fighting. Their shells were exploding all over, and there was an awful racket, machine gun fire, and so on. And that was the 23rd. The 24th, we're taken there to Argyle Street. Argyle Street Prison of War Camp. It wasn't a prison of war camp there, but right then, at that time. And there I met some, there was a British nurse down there, Armed Forces nurse. Again, I was asking for water, and she had some water in the bottle. She gave me some water. But this is, then these people were separated, and we were brought from there, from Argyle Street. I'm sorry, it wasn't Argyle Street, it was North Point. That's where we went from the soap factory to North Point. From there we were brought back on the mainland. And there we went to Champchipo. There was only a little bunch of us. Very few Canadians. I wouldn't say there was no more than you 25. The main body had gone someplace else. And most of us were wounded. We stayed there until in Champchipo. No, it wasn't Champchipo. No, it was Argyle Street. That's from North Point, we went to Argyle Street. It's like I said, it was only a little bunch. Later on, from Argyle Street, there were, like I said, a bunch of us were wounded. We had no blankets, no nothing, but just the clothes right on. And we were stuffed on the cold cement floor and had a brick for a pillow and treatment. There was no treatment whatsoever.
Nobody had fixed your wounds during these 3 or 4 days that you were marching
around? No, when I arrived at the North at Argyle Street, they did put a bandage on it, but they had nothing to work on, just only bandage. And There was no hospital. I had dysentery then and diarrhea. And from there, then we went to Saint-Chapeau. And first of all, we were with the Royal Scots, attached to the Royal Scots. That's the funny part of it. The Royal Scots just would cook the rice. That's all we had was rice, twice a day. And they do, there was kind of a sloppy rice, all with water. And they'd look down the line up, and they'd say, well, gee, we're going to run short of rice. So they'd take a bucket of water and throw this rice into the which was in the bathtub, and they swirled it all in there, and there was enough rice for that. Okay. So we left the Royal Scots, and we were attached to the Royal Artillery. Well, at least the rice was better. We got more of it. Then we went from Champchipo to North Point again this time. That was in North Point, let's see. That was the beginning of June, the end of May. Mm-hmm. And I still know that my wound hadn't been cleaned up or anything like that. It's all big bag of pus, and it's all swelled up and oozing and all that. And from there, it was exactly 6 months to the date that I was operated on my leg, and they cleaned the wound and so on. And that helped me out. I went to Bowen Road. No. Not Bowen Road. It was the British Military Hospital there. Must be Bowen Road Hospital. That's what I mean. That's Bowen Road Hospital, Military Hospital. And I was operated there by British, well, it was called the British Military Hospital. From there, I came back to North Point. I certainly didn't want to leave the hospital there because we were sleeping in bed and the sheets and so on, you know. But we went back to the old prison camp again, with no bed, no nothing, no sheet, no blanket, no nothing. And then from then on, from North Point, we went back to Champchipo. And I stayed in Champchipo until the end of the war.
So you never went to Japan?
No, because when the first draft was taken to go to Japan, I had malaria. And I wasn't chosen. When the second draft was chosen to go to Japan, I was in dysentery hospital. So I missed that second one. Mm-hmm. And the third one, well, then by that time, you know, they took the healthiest people at that time. I was never picked up to go to Japan.
How was your leg during this time? Could you walk around after they fixed
it? I could always walk. But my leg was stiff until after the operation, and then with a bit of physiotherapy, well, there was no such a thing, but the leg finally bent, and I could walk. But I got a great big hole in the leg here.
Did they make you work any time this
year? Oh, yes. When that, we worked there all over, working the airport, Kaitak Airport there. And a few years ago, I went back there, and they were laughing. They were saying, well, I was a construction engineer down there. So I was hauling dirt with a basket and pole. So we worked at Kaitak Airport. I worked at Lachikok, which that's where the oil refinery. Not so much a refinery, but there was oil tanks there. That had been blown up by the Americans. We worked there, and we mostly work on the airport most of the time, picking shovel and labor work, and work at the. I also worked digging gardens for the Japanese. We made air raid shelters and all kinds of things. Always picking shovel.
What was the food like? Did it get any better? Did it change, or was it just a big race pretty long?
Well, it got better after a while. Actually, later on, we did have some gardens. And twice a week, Wednesdays and Sundays, we'd take vegetables from our garden and have a bigger meal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you do this, didn't
it? Yes. But there was never a sufficient amount of food. Never had enough. We're always hungry day in and day out.
double Red Cross packages. Did you receive
any? I received 3.5 all the time I was there. I never received Prince of Comfort parcel. And
what were the guards like? What did you think of the guards? Were they really mean, or were they all right?
You couldn't. They wouldn't trust you. Couldn't trust them. The Formosans were not too bad. And there was a Hondo was a Korean. He wasn't bad. He was a sergeant major. But of course, like I said, you'd watch them. You never trusted them, and so on. And when we're strictly a Canadian working party, we always only Canadians alone. We always go along better than we were with the British, because we would pretend to work, at least make an effort, make a show. But the Japanese didn't like if you were in the working party and have a bunch of guys sitting down doing nothing. Then they start beating you up and working harder. But if you make a show, you know, and then sit around and so on, and at first it was tough when Kamloops used to come on the working party, and we start 5:30 in the morning until late at night, and we rebel at 5:30. It was pretty tough, but after Kamloops wasn't there anymore, and the promotion took over, things were better.
He was pretty mean then,
wasn't he? Well, Kamloops was always, he didn't like Canadians at all. And, he was a Canadian, see, Canadian Japanese.
All the time that you're in camp, were there any radios that you knew, or did you receive any information from the
outside? We knew there were radios there, and we did have news of the outside world. I know one time there was a Dutch submarine crew. A Dutch submarine had been sunk by the Japanese. And they were attached to Canadians, and they had a radio. They were caught with that radio, and some of the people got some awful bad beatings there. Some of the British had radios. I know one day when I was in Bowen Road, we used to have piping music, and somewhere I forgot to throw the wrong switch, and we started to hear a static that you hear from a radio. I knew there was a radio there, but so I was trying to tune in on the wavelengths.
Yeah.
You could hear that a bit over the. But these things, it got pretty. Once a few people got caught with radios, you see, they'd get beaten up so bad, and some of them were, I think, went to jail or Stanley Prison. Mm-hmm. So everybody was so darn scared of being caught with a radio that they didn't away with. But I did hear that afterward there was still something. But as far as the news is concerned, we used to get it to the fans and so on. That was the Hong Kong volunteers, you see. They could get news from the city itself, and there was ways. There was always news going on there. We knew. And then the Japanese had a newspaper called the Hong Kong News. It was a propaganda paper, but even through the propaganda, we knew how the war was going. We knew that they were fighting in North Africa, and that the British were winning the war in North Africa, and they were putting the... And when the Americans started hopping from one island to the other, like the Carolines, the Bonin Islands, and Truk, and Okinawa, and all that, we knew the progress. And when the war was over in Europe, it was no news to us, because we expected it any day. You see, we had what was called a bamboo telegraph. One person, the news was traveled from one person to another. I got my news from Bill Doobie. Now, when passed it down to somebody else, and around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, somebody come tell this is the latest rumor, and he'd tell you what he'd heard, and he'd pass it on to somebody. And it's a funny thing, the Japanese could never trace where these news came from, because it was too much, it was from one person to the other. It was.
Yeah.
And I remember when the war was over in Europe, La Fortune was talking to him at that meeting there. He came in the afternoon. He says, the war is over in Europe. It didn't fizz on us because, like I said, we're expecting it any day. We had heard that the Americans and the Russians were expected to meet both lines from east and west, were supposed to meet within the week or so. They were expected to meet. So when the war was over in Europe, we knew that if the Americans and the Russians met, that was the end of the Germans. So when the war was over in Europe, it didn't. Well, it was good news, but it wasn't. That was being closer to liberation. But then, I myself, I was so sure that we would only be there a few in the length of time that I said with. It was said to myself, and was saying, well, by August the 1st, I will be free. The war will be over here. I may have been often awful optimistic. But see, August the 1st is my birthday, and I was sure that I would be free for my birthday. And when my birthday came, well, that's it's just a matter of days. No, it's any day now. It's any day now. And... But when we heard about the war being over, we were going on a working party. And there's a Chinese girl came by on a bicycle. And she said to us as she went by, the war is over. She went around the block and came around a second time and went by and said, the war is over. Well, then we're getting pretty excited. A little farther down the street, there was an Indian there. He had his goat. And he was beating his goat with his walking stick and shouting, you surrendered, you bastard. You surrendered, you bastard. Well, we knew that there was something wrong. So we're all excited. Well, of course, we had to keep it down because the Japs were still our guardians. We went to the airport to work. We work a little bit, and about 10 o'clock in the morning, they call a break. We hung around there until about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We had dinner and everything. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, there's an officer that came down there. He called the guards, and we were sent back to camp. And... the war was over. Well, they wouldn't work with us anymore. So we definitely were sure that the war was over. Actually, it wasn't then. Not quite a few days later. So when we came back, there was an orderly officer was called, and all working, then the Japs said that all working parties would be suspended until further notice. Well, then there was an uproar in camp. That was sure the war was over. That, it's a funny thing that it was so good to be, too good to be true. You know, we kept on saying the war is over, but it's, after all those years, it was too good to be true.
Well, had you saw any Americans up to this time? Had they been coming over?
No.
And
we were in Hong Kong.
They never came
but there were some American airplanes that, I don't know if it wasn't that day, a few days later, came by. Some airplanes, which I think were American. They dropped some leaflets and told us to stay where we were. The Japanese, the war was over, the Japanese were responsible for our safety until the arrival of liberation troops. Mm-hmm. So, but then as soon as the war was over, well, then the officers and so on told the Japs to get their guards out of the camp, and we wanted some radios, and we want this and that, you know, and we want better food. So anyway, we did get better food. We started getting some meat there, which we hadn't seen for about 3 years anyway. And more rice, more of a thing. So actually, we're not hungry anymore. I mean,
were you allowed to leave the camp? Did you go outside of the prison camp and get more food, or did you stay right in?
No, there was working parties went down to get food. And I know one day we went swimming. But there still were Japs all over the place, you know. But we went in as a body, marched to the beach. And still were saying we want to keep it cool because we didn't want to get shot after being down there. So we kept on saying to ourselves, well, to everybody, said, well, let's keep it down. Let's not aggravate those guys, because after being here all that long, and now we're free, we don't want to get shot after the war is over. So we kept it pretty cool. But then the fleet did come. And the British fleet, and there was all kinds of ships there. And then the Prince Robert, which is a Canadian cruiser, came to Hong Kong. And this is where this picture was taken there, with Commander McRitchie, the ship photographer took this picture. Mm-hmm. And that was taken in my hut, where I was. And then we went to the onboard ship. Again, we were taking a chance going to the Japanese and all that, because the ship had just got it down there, but the troops were not there yet. And we went down, we took a rickshaw, went down to the Prince Robert, and we were all come on board, and they give us some food, and give us some clothes, and some shoes, and it was a good party, so we came back with some coffee, and some sugar, and a few goodies out of that, so we made a great big bonfire in the middle of the floor of the hut, and we bought some coffee with canned milk, and so it was helpful. It tasted awfully good.
Can you describe how you got back then to Canada and Winnipeg from there?
Well, from then, when the British, the fleet came in anyway, a few days later. Mm-hmm. And we left there and we were taken on board the Empress of Australia from Hong Kong to Manila, mm-hmm. where all this flooding was this week. That's where the plains of Manila, the plains of Luzon, that's where we were. They were the Americans took over. We went to an American base there. And then we were given American uniforms. Because as you see, that was my clothing there. It was in drags, you see. And we did that for it. We were just fragging on, and old shoes worn down. And Americans gave us complete American boots and stockings and trousers and shirts and caps and underwear and so on. I stayed there, about maybe 8 to 10 days. And then I came by boat, the Admiral Hughes, which is an American troop ship, from Manila to Esquimalt. We were supposed to go to San Francisco, but at sea we were told to land in Esquimalt, because most of the troops were extras of war, mostly Canadian and British. Mm-hmm. There was no very few American prisoners of war then, because they'd been liberated. And from there we came to Esquimalt. In Esquimalt we stayed there for about 48 hours. And then we were issued with Canadian uniforms. And those that came, a few came back on Red Cross ship, but these are fellows that couldn't manage it, they couldn't walk. I tell you, you had to be awful sick, not to get along, not to walk, and so on. You'd crawl if you could have done it. And then from Esquimalt, we were given passes. Like I said, we're all very sick, very poor shape, weak, very thin. So on, but we were given passes to go home, 45-day pass. And from there, well, I was in DLH for about a year afterwards, after I came back.
What was your attitude toward the Canadian government after you came back? Did you think they treated you fairly?
No, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, that was our faith. We could have went to Europe and have been blown to bits down there, crippled for life. So as far as I was concerned, well, could have been worse. And as far as the Japanese is concerned, the war is over. It's been over for a long, long time, and I don't hold them any grudge and resentment. So, the war is over, and when it was over, it was all over as far as I'm concerned.
When you were back in the prison camp, did you have anything to do, like for recreation, or were you?
Yeah, well, recreation, well, we did play cards and so on, but more or less talk and jokes, and, well, whatever. But although there were concerts down there, which were very good for the morale, and stuff, concerts every once in a while, they were good for the morale. And then we had some musical instrument later on, and there was a band, you know, and some music and so on.
And while you were there, did you ever think of trying to escape, or do you remember anybody that ever tried?
Yes, as far as I'm concerned, me trying to escape, I couldn't escape because I wasn't strong enough. I was too weak. You know, I always had dysentery and malaria and all those things, you see. And malaria all the time, and dysentery, and always had diarrhea. But I know that Sergeant Payne was in a Corps company, and I knew him personally very well, and he escaped. And we found out later on that they had been recaptured and murdered with the Japanese. But Sergeant Payne, I knew him very well, because every time when it was raining, we'd have roll call on our hut. They escaped from North Point. And Sergeant Payne used to always sit in his tent in front of me. And I know one guy that had a pair of boots that Sergeant Payne wore. Part of the guy said he was stolen, but these boots were stolen, but I'm sure they weren't stolen from him. But we did find out that we had heard in the prison camp that had been recaptured, that somebody had been in a stranded prison and had seen them, and by the description of those fellows, we knew that they had been recaptured.
Just as the last couple of questions, you don't hold any grudge against the Japanese people or anything?
No, the war is over as far as I'm concerned. But don't go and praise them, though, because I can always let bygones be bygones. But these people that come, you see in Canada, these people that come and start telling you about the atomic bomb and how the Japanese were treated, I can tell them the other side of the story.
Mm-hmm. And just as the last question, what do you think about war? Do you think it's a necessary thing, or did you think it was necessary? Or
as far as I'm concerned, I'm glad I went there. Because I'd rather have met them down there than have them met here in Portage. And if war ever comes again, let's fight it in somebody else's country, not in our own backyard. Because I fought that in that backyard, and I found out what happened.
Oh, and just one more. Did your 3.5 years of imprisonment, did they bother you anyway now or after the war?
I'm still suffering from it.
Would this be your heart still from that?
My heart, my legs, arthritis and so on. Well, I was very young. I recovered much better than if I was older. The young, very young people have got, most of them are in better shape.
And you're still working today, isn't
it? I'm in the Air Force.
Well, you're in the Air Force. Is your importance? Oh, I see. Okay, thanks very much, sir.
Okay.